Okay, so keep in mind that slurp was loud in my ears.
Yeah, I was thinking, how are we going to know?
Actually, in Coffs, just out of Coffs Harbour, there's a just recently formed within the last year or two is the Myanmar Agricultural Cooperative, which are Burmese refugees that have come over and they wanted to get back on the land. So they've found some land and they're, I think there's about 10 families that are farming together on this land, and they came out here. We invited them out when I heard what was going on, and apparently on the car ride out, they all came in a little minivan. Yep. Some of them were like crying and saying, oh, this is just like home. And yeah, it was really so emotional special for them. Mm. So they're just sort of getting up and going. But, you know, hopefully we see more of that because there is so much skill and knowledge there.
G'day, Anthony James here for The Regeneration. Back in Derby, in the spectacular Kimberley region in the far northwest of WA. It's been 18 months since we were last here, and within just a few days we're being blown away all over again by some of the extraordinary stuff happening here, along with the at times hard to believe threats that are also stepping up, as they're doing almost everywhere of course. But for more charting ways for the sorts of places more of us actually want to live in, stay tuned for more from the Kimberley next month. For the rest of June though, it's back east for a series of episodes I've been holding back till now. That's because the first Australian feature film on regenerative agriculture, and as always, all other related systems, is premiering in Sydney this week, having already premiered to acclaim in Santa Barbara, California. Rachel's Farm is made by none other than Rachel Ward, the famed actress, filmmaker, and now grandmother. It's about her deeply felt, unexpected and incredibly uplifting journey to becoming a regenerative farmer. Rachel will be on the podcast next week, coinciding with the announcement of her touring the film throughout July. But today features a brilliant young couple who appear in the film, Casey Simong, who you heard at the top, and Tom McIndoe.
I just think it's sort of just intrinsic to who we are. We're not really looking at it from a monetary perspective. It's just to be on this land is privilege enough. And if we just never want to see a repetition of previous mismanagement.
Tom and Casey are descendants respectively of Scottish Highlanders and Lao rice farmers and somewhat accidental refugees. And as it happens, Casey spent some formative time in the Kimberley at Mornington when she was 19. Now she's with Tom, running Mandarin Bend Farm in the beautiful Nambucca Valley, Gumbunya country on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. But not only that, with a bunch of neighbouring producers, they've gone on to start the North Arm Farms Co-op, a unique food-to-market setup with deep community roots, stewardship ethos, and enterprise model that sends 100% of what we spend on our food directly to the farmers. I recently visited them at the farm, 400 acres of forest and grassland regeneration, and extraordinary market garden. And I followed the delivery van on distribution day too. A van carrying the slogan, "Farm like the world depends on it." Before we start, great thanks to Samuel Johnson this week for your generous donation. And to this week's guests, Tom and Casey, for being amongst the very first supporters of the podcast back in 2020. It's the way this ad-free, listener-supported podcast happens. So if you're also finding value in this, please consider joining Samuel, Tom and Casey and a great community of supporting listeners with as little as $3 a month or whatever amount you can and want to contribute. You can enjoy a variety of benefits, including early news of events, some behind-the-scenes stuff from me, and of course you'll continue to receive the podcast every week, even a little more often than that in coming weeks. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support, and thanks again. Okay, let's take a seat with Casey and Tom on the balcony at their place. Casey and Tom, thanks for having me at your place. It is unbelievable, really, to be here, considering you've been a supporter of the podcast for a couple of years. We've been in touch in that time, and you know, I've heard about this place. I haven't actually spent much time around this region. Probably not many Australians have, to tell you the truth. So to come out here and be just blown away on arrival has been really something. And thanks for having us.
Thanks for having you out here, AJ. It's been a long time coming. We've been very excited to have you.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, thanks. So let's bring listeners in to what I've been fortunate enough to rock up to today. On the one hand, sure, geographical and what we're sitting amongst, but on the other hand, how it strikes you.
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful place up here. We're in the headwaters of the Nambucca River, which is on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, about an hour and a bit south of Coffs Harbour. And this place is nestled within the north arm of the Nambucca Valley. And the river runs through the middle of the farm here, and it's just a really special place where we have the New England World Heritage Wilderness area to the west of us, and the coast to the east, and we've got the best of both worlds.
But you are tucked right up in the valley.
We sure are.
Yeah.
We're 30 k's inland of Bowraville, so it's sort of a one-way road which becomes unsealed, so it's a narrow, windy dirt road, and you're kind of meandering through the valley, and there's just beautiful, luscious green river flats, and then forest either side of the road, and we're deep in the womb, as I often call it.
Yeah.
It's like where we drive further and further into this tight, narrow valley, and it's just this real place of this really fertile, nurturing, beautiful place that we are lucky to call home.
Yeah, you feel like you're being hugged by it up here. It's really special.
Yeah, Jesus, some beautiful metaphors in there.
Yeah.
The obvious question in a way, how did you come to be here?
Yeah, so we've got family ties. Dad's side of the family are traditionally, they came from the Dorigo district, which is to the north of us here. And yeah, we were sort of toying about trying to find a farm together for many years. I grew up in Newcastle, and Case grew up down in Albury. So yeah, we're both first generation to this valley. But yeah, Dad and I were sort of looking around this district, and I'd come into this valley on a random motorbike ride actually one day with my family, and just was blown away by how spectacular this this North Arm is. And yeah, we actually a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, we were sort of looking for property, and this was actually the first place that we came onto, and it was like, you know, there's just something.
Really was it really?
About it. Yeah. So
this is so interesting.
Need no more. Yeah.
This is so. I don't know. I wonder if you felt it. Like,
yeah.
I even took note where we've just been. Where we met, in fact.
Yeah.
At Rachel Ward and Brian Brown's place, because we were there because of the upcoming film release.
Yep.
Rachel's farm that you're in, as it happens. My first sighter of you, aside from your website, of course, was in this film, and then we come together there, and here we are now. Yep. It's not far away. But that farm for them was also the first one they visited.
Yeah.
And so I hear enough of this. I hear enough of this to not take it for granted that, I mean, how does that happen?
Yeah.
How does it repeatedly be the first thing that you...
Yeah.
And so was our home, even back west, for that matter, as I think about it.
Yeah.
The first place we saw when we dedicated our minds to it.
Yeah.
But how, for you, Casey, I guess, did you feel anything in that in particular? Or you didn't pay that much mind? It was like, whatever, it's about the place. That's what's really turning me on here.
Well, I moved up about 6 months after Tom. We weren't really together at that point.
Really?
We met through farming. I was living down near Port Macquarie, farming on my own little market garden there on this guy's property. Tom's parents lived up the road. I actually met Tom at the Port Macquarie Farmers Market selling veggies, and he was on another stall selling veggies. And then we kind of were seeing each other a bit, on and off, and then he moved up here, and then the first time I came to visit him and I saw it, I was like, yeah, wow, this is this is really it. I think I'll I'll move up. And yeah, it was kind of, we were, I just sort of moved up to farm with him because I was slogging away by myself farming and he was up here by himself farming. And so it just sort of seemed like the next logical step would be to farm together. Yeah, so I
so you weren't necessarily thinking the package deal at that time?
No, it was pretty weird because it was, it was, it's, you know, it's intense having a business with someone, yet alone a farming business, yet alone living with them in a semi-rural area. And we'd only sort of known each other for 6 or 8 months.
Mm. Yeah.
So it was kind of like, let's just farm together, you know, and then we've just fallen into our beautiful relationship over the years.
Yeah. No, I hear you, that intensity. And when you are, what you love about being removed a bit and there's not really a passers-by thing up here.
Yeah, true.
And you love that, but it leaves you. Obviously, there's a community. We'll get to some of that too as we talk. But,
cool.
But still, no, I appreciate that. So it's interesting that it's sort of crept up on you in that way.
Yeah. And to add another layer to that, just after I decided to move up here, before I'd actually moved up, I think, but within a week or two beforehand, I found out that I had thyroid cancer.
No.
Yeah, 27 years of age. But I'd visited Tom maybe a month or two beforehand up here, and weirdly, I had this thought come into my head that was like, if I had cancer, this is where I would want to be. And I was like, whoa, where did that come from?
That was before you knew.
Before I knew, yeah. Yeah. And then I know that was maybe my body or something trying to tell me, like, this is where you need to be. This is what's coming or whatever. Yeah.
That is interesting.
Yeah, and I've always thought of it as a really healing space, and it really did become my healing space.
Really? How are you?
Great. Really? Yeah, it's been 5 years, and I ended up getting half of my thyroid removed. I sat on it for a while, and I tried to do everything alternative that I could, and I ended up deciding to get half of my thyroid removed against the surgeon's recommendation, which was to take it all out bomb yourself with radioactive iodine. I refused that, and now I've got half a thyroid doing the work of the whole thing, and I don't have to take any artificial replacement hormones. So
get out.
I'm good.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's actually really something.
Yeah.
The body's adaptive capacity continues to blow me away.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But the strength of your conviction, though, to do that at such a young age, where did that come from?
You question.
I question everything, and I've always had a distrust in empire and authority. And
really?
Yeah, and I just came home as soon as I found out, came home and did all my research, and you know, and it's funny, I see cancer as it's a wake-up call. It's not a death threat unless you want, you know, unless you're that way inclined. And I think it's actually a gift for some of us to you know, take that journey, because it is a real journey.
No doubt.
And yeah, I guess I've always backed myself, really.
Mm.
So no surgeon could tell me what I should do with my body.
Bang. So, all right. Let's keep going. Where did that come from? In all seriousness. Is it something in your, like, I think, is it your mother? Like, or is there somewhere you can trace that you saw that to just have it become you? Or was it later?
My mum's a very gentle, follow-the-rules kind of lady. So I don't think it's my mum. Hmm. And maybe my dad is, in a way. He was a refugee after the Vietnam War and came over here, and a really interesting story which I won't go on about, but he sort of just ended up here at 16 by accident.
Can you tell us a little?
Yeah. Yeah, so he he was 16, living on the border of Laos and Thailand, and his older brother, my Uncle Sam, we call him, he came back.
Which is ironic.
It's no real name.
Yeah. Ironic. Given the war. Perspective.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so he'd met a partner and had been living in Thailand. He came back to Laos to visit the family. And then I think they sort of said, we're going back to Thailand to go to a refugee camp. Or I'm not sure if they wanted to go there or they just sort of ended up there. But Dad was like, oh, can I come with?
Wow.
And
I'd never think about that happening much.
Yeah, and Dad just, like, went along for the ride. So they stole a buffalo, tied their belongings.
This is getting better.
Tied their belongings in a plastic bag and tied it to the buffalo and then swam across the Mekong River at night with the buffalo, got to Thailand, ended up in a refugee camp. And then because they entered as a unit, they were sort of documented as a family together. So while they're in there, they met this other guy who I call my uncle, but he's not really. Uncle Pat, we'll call him. and he got sort of sponsored to go out to Australia. This is, you know, all been told from various people. Apparently Sam and my dad gave him whatever they had and said, you know, good luck. See you later. And then he ended up in Albury of all places. And then I think he lied and said that my dad and my uncle were his brothers. And so they then got sponsored to come out. But my dad didn't really want to come. But because they were on the documentation as a unit, they had to go as a unit or fake my dad's death so he could go back home. And so he just sort of came along for the ride and ended up in Albury, where there's quite a Lao community there.
That is amazing.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say he's like a fighter or something, but I guess that, you know, there's something there.
There is something there.
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. And so you're in Albury, New South Wales, on the border of Victoria. You grow up just outside of that. And we talked a bit about this, not before last, wasn't it? That while there's a little Lao community there, otherwise it's pretty isolated in terms of culture. It's pretty white.
Yeah, well, where I grew up, which is half an hour outside Albury in Hao Long, is very white. I think it was just me and my sister and an Indigenous family who were our good friends, who were the only non-white people at school.
Yeah.
But Albury wasn't too bad. It became a bit of a resettlement area. So there's quite a few Lao and Thai, like quite a big population of Lao and Thai people there. But where I grew up is up until 12, it was very, very rural and a bit isolating. So, yeah, it was interesting growing up my parents ended up splitting when I was about 4, and I'd spend every second weekend at my dad's house. And it was full Lao culture, like, women were inside playing cards. The guys are outside on the barbecue drinking whiskey, singing Lao songs. Ha. And so I had this real, you know, I was playing netball for the Hao Long country, you know, league one weekend. And then the next I'm in this really, you know, crazy Lao party running around with all the kids. So that was kind of my two worlds growing up.
It sounds good in a way. Like that there was that blend. Is that how you feel about it?
Yeah, it was definitely hard because I feel like I never really fit in with Australian culture because I'm not white, even though I was born here. But I never really fit in with the Lao culture either because I wasn't fully Lao.
Yeah,
so
it's classic.
I think there's a lot of people in my boat that kind of grow up not fitting in.
Is there what?
Yeah.
We, of course, spoke about my wife as a case in point. But all the more in farming then. This is something that you're experiencing is true of farming too.
Yeah. We did joke about this too. Is that it's a pretty white industry in Australia, I guess. Certainly not many female. I guess I'm coloured. It's kind of like, you know,
what am I? What are you? I know. What label do you fit today? Yeah. In our best attempts to not just be white. This is true, even in broadly regenerative circles. But are you experiencing a change? Is it less so? Is it shifting?
Not really. maybe just not in our circles. Like, we went to a conference in December for a regen ag conference, and it was pretty much all middle-aged to late sort of white males. There's a handful of females.
But, like, they're changing the face of farming publication. There's so many case studies in that.
Yeah, definitely lots more females coming through in our style of farming, the small scale market gardening. I'd say that's becoming quite female-dominated.
Totally.
Which is awesome.
Yes. Yeah, Rachel and I talk about this, actually. It's probably not a coincidence either. Mm. There's probably layers to that. But it's also, it strikes me as ironic in a way, but also just part of our lost opportunity at the moment, that I think of all the people from your ancestral background who were farmers. Like, this is like thousands of years of expertise.
Mm.
And sure, not all of them will want to, but you can't be the only one. Surely. But how do you feel about that? Like, is there something in that community, that with all that expertise, is it another case of a community with unrecognized expertise that could be invited in, welcomed in, assisted in to these spaces?
Yeah. Well, actually, in Coffs, just out of Coffs Harbour, there's a just recently formed within the last year or two is the Myanmar Agricultural Cooperative,
really,
which are Burmese refugees that have come over and they wanted to get back on the land. So they've found some land, and I think there's about 10 families that are farming together on this land, and they came out here. We invited them out when I heard what was going on. And apparently on the car ride out, they all came in a little minivan. Some of them were like crying and saying, oh, this is just like home. And it was really emotional for them. Mm. So they're just sort of getting up and going. Hopefully we see more of that, because there is so much skill and knowledge there. And, some of it's transferable, some of it's not.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's a totally different country, different soil and everything like that. But
I think there's
a passion and a love for land there.
And it's in the DNA, right? Isn't it, really? And in that way, there's some parallels to First Nations folk here. It's different in an incredibly long duration here in this place. But the parallels are there on a few fronts, including that, I hear from them a lot too, that it's so different now because of what we've been doing. Mm. And in that sense, white settler Australia has never really come to know it yet.
Mm.
We're in that process too. So in a sense, we're all in that boat of it's not the places we know or we knew.
Yeah.
How do we go from here?
If anything, the Burmese or the Myanmar people would be, more familiar with a climate like this. We're in the subtropics here, so their farming systems would probably transfer.
It'll be interesting to see.
It'd be much more streamlined, you'd think, than something that's traditionally European that we've struggled with to integrate into this country and failed at.
You guys are cases in point too, hey, being first arrivals to this valley and having to find your way.
Yeah.
So how's that been?
Mm. Well, geez, we've seen everything. Hey, like we've only been here 6 years, and we've seen the full spectrum of conditions to farm within.
Mm.
We're still here at the end of the day, which is pretty cool. But not too far after moving here into 2017, the East Coast went into record drought and that followed with catastrophic fire, which we were very lucky to sort of be within, we were within you know, a stone's throw of it, but I managed to escape it here in the North Arm, and and you know, and then we've had successions of La Nina years and some record flooding, so yeah, so it's been quite a an interesting
roller coaster,
interesting,
which is sort of several looks years. Like the
yeah totally
the way know, from here.
That's
hey?
It. That's yeah. it. You know, and that's sort of reflective of in our farming style. We're trying to adapt to that and to sort of ensure ourselves a harvest moving forward into the future.
Yeah.
Through
are there key ways that?
Yeah, definitely, and you know, small scale market farming is really adaptive to, you know, the conditions at hand, right? It, you know, we're not throwing big volumes of capital into planting a crop and you know, we can sort of be nimble and flexible, you know, if we get wiped out by a hailstorm, which, you know, we're relatively...
Dodged a bullet yeah, a couple of times now.
But, yeah, you know, it's only a matter of time, I guess. But, you know, the way we farm is that we can be sort of back and getting produce to people within, you know, only a couple of weeks. So,
really?
You know, and yeah, I think that's...
It'd be 8 weeks till we're pretty much in full production again. But really? After four, we could be putting stuff on the table, which is pretty cool.
That's amazing. It's, yeah. To me, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, last year taught a lesson in the importance of covering crops during those really wet periods. We're sort of investing in tunnels to, you know, ensure a harvest, you know, in future wet years and various things like, you know, we've had, you know, bowerbird infestations come in and take crop and, you know, just trying to make the garden more resilient, investing in sort of certain covers and various tunnels to be able to protect that. And, you know,
started doing sprouts, which sprouts are done awesome. In a seedling house, so that, you know, we can produce those regardless of what the climate is outside.
Yes.
Mm. And they're a sort of 7 to 10 day turnaround. So looking at those little things that we can do to keep producing in tougher conditions.
Yeah, it's totally. Such a big point, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so much a lot of us have learned in recent years, the For vulnerabilities
sure.
there.
For sure.
And strangely, in a way, in places like this, where stuff is grown.
Yeah.
But you were saying before.
Yeah.
The food insecurity and the food quality around here, and they're related, obviously, is not good.
Totally. I think you'd find that in the regions everywhere you go. Yeah,
pretty much I see that.
You know, there are pockets that are, you know, that are pockets that are against that grain, but generally right across the place, it's, you know, the Nambucca's an example of that. We've been a region that's produced a lot of diverse vegetable and fruit crops in the past and still do today, but you know, the bulk of that's exported out of the region, and what we're left with is usually the stuff that comes on the back of trucks from all corners of the country that's you know, that's generally really poor quality, and there's not really the option, you know, you can't really go down to the local organic wholesaler.
Yeah, there's not really any shops in the whole valley that have fresh local produce. I think one does a tiny bit, but it's really just, you know, a couple, you know, Food Works, Woolworths, and
the usual
really
suspects.
Your only option.
There's been a bit of a culture of roadside farm stalls that have been in the area, but you know, again, it's hit and miss. So yeah, that's where
North Arm Farms comes in.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Let's get to that in a moment. But
yeah,
have you sought to be in these shops with what you're producing?
We, given the scale that we no. farm at, exactly. No, it's pretty
definitely
well.
Definitely not, it's, a desire.
No, the largely the reason is people are with the lower quality produce, obviously the price is often reflective of that too. So, you know, we're so accustomed in this country to be paying not often what a farmer should be getting at the farm gate, right? So, you know, like...
Even cost in a way.
Well, that's it.
Not even the operations are largely not even viable on their own.
Yeah.
Which is just extraordinary to think that's how we operate our food system, which I guess is your... a strong aversion that you had just expressed, Casey, to that. It's like you'd be trying to plug into a system. Well, it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, no, no, totally not. Not on our scale, that's for sure.
Yeah, our scale relies on getting 100% of that dollar. And as soon as you start playing with those supermarkets, you're only going to be getting 50%.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Yeah. So it just wouldn't work for us anyway. We'd have to be bigger, which we don't want to be, because then you're just farming more to make the same amount of money. Doesn't really stack up.
Yeah.
And and feeding into that broken system.
Yeah.
So we created our own.
All right. Let's back up and trace over something we left off before we come back.
Yeah, cool.
And that is you coming out here by yourself then. So just run us by. So you saw this property on the market.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
And you're like, this has to be...
Yeah, Dad actually spotted it on the market. He was sort of looking around. I was between... I'd come back from traveling and was sort of a little bit... I wasn't lost. I was very sort of... I was very focused on more or less the permaculture dream or the...
Really?
You know, the sort of farming lifestyle.
How long had that been? As a Newcastle urban rat skater surfer
it was always funnily, in his blood.
Yeah, totally. Because, really? You know, my dad's side of the family were generational dairy farmers at Dorigo. Yes. And Dad's father, my grandfather, he was a really progressive dairy farmer. In fact, he was an Nuffield scholar. So he sort of travelled the world and implemented. He actually brought a lot of first practices back to Australia, like one of the first people to bring in electric fencing and silage production. And so he was seen as a really progressive dairy farmer, certainly not an organic one. He was riding on the coattails of post-Second World War, Green Revolution style farming, right? So it certainly wasn't the style of farming that we're sort of into and practicing these days. Yeah. But I had a lot of respect for my grandfather, and I guess we always associated ourselves with Dorigo growing up and had connections. We still have family up there, and we sort of sought refuge in that country. Every school holidays we'd go and spend time on the family farm, and got to know and love it as I sort of entered my younger teenage years. And I guess as that evolved, my brother and I particularly sort of started putting little seeds in my mum and stepdad's mind about potentially trying to find some country. We'd go out on the weekends to the bush around Newcastle, out into the Hunter Valley and up the North Coast, and sort of start, we were starting to form those foundations of trying to look for a bit of a bush block, a bit of rural land. And so, during my sort of high school years, my folks ended up selling their little house in inner city Newcastle, in a pretty scabby suburb at the time, but it's really gentrified now, funnily enough. But they found a little bush block. Completely, the only thing that was on it was a leveled pad and a sort of a rough, very rough boundary fence. And we spent every weekend as teenagers going through high school, getting up to the bush and just getting our hands dirty on that little piece of land. And funnily enough, when I was sort of in the later years of my high schooling in Newcastle, I'd learnt about this incredibly inspiring project called Kurrugang City Farm on Ash Island, which is just on the northern outskirts of Newcastle. It was a sort of a collaboration between the old catchment management networks and Landcare and several other organisations. And they were actually pretty early practitioners of holistic grazing management.
Really?
And sort of rehabilitating a wetland, a Ramsar-listed wetland that was heavily degraded during the BHP years. It was set stocked and just a really degraded piece of land. And they opened this place up to the public once the grazing systems were put in place and the rainforest corridors were planted, and there was all these interpretive signs and walks through the farm, and that was just like, that was just like boom for me. I was like, how good is, you know, how good is this?
How old were you then?
I was probably 15 or something, and ended up, you know, spending every moment I could, I'd go fishing over there and just hanging out. I'd just go over there on my own and just sit out on the wharf and and go and watch the cattle in the paddock crazily and, you know. And and so, yeah, that was a really, like, crux moment for me. I, you know, that really sort of cemented some modalities in my mind. And yeah, when we got the farm, I started sort of buying and selling cattle and, you know, and...
That was the first thing you did?
Yeah, I bought my first cow and calf at 18 and we sort of, yeah, I just set to setting the farm up and, you know, and planting veggies and getting fruit trees in.
There you go.
It was awesome. And that sort of, like, both Case and I have environmental science backgrounds. We went and studied, you know, studied those things, and I went and did a catchment management specialisation and yeah, moved into that field and then went travelling and wolfing and anyway.
Honing all of it. Yeah,
exactly. So it's been, like, for me, it's been, I don't know, now it's over half my lifetime that I've been sort of, even though I grew up in a city, Newcastle, it's sort of been, it's been such a strong foundation for me. And, it just made sense to, you know, for me, wolfing really actually was like that just meeting all those different people around the world and seeing so many different farming systems was just the inspiration and all that came from that. That was like,
got to do it
with all the problems in the world
as well.
Yeah. Giving, you know, traveling through those countries and seeing, you know, where I could fit into all this bigger picture stuff.
Yeah. It was.
There it is, farming. I've got to be doing that. So.
So you found this place.
Yeah.
Had you worked up enough capital in your exports? Yeah. How'd you do that?
Yeah. So dad owns the property and we lease it from him.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're super lucky from that perspective. Dad always had the idea of, you know, having some country, which, you know, we, my brother and I and, you know, family could return to if we could never get country on Dorigo.
Yes.
Then hopefully it'd be close enough by to still have that connection with that country.
Yeah.
So this was the next sort of best option the Nambucca was calling, and we worked out an arrangement where, you know, I do a lot of the farm improvements. So this place had some infrastructure on it, but a lot of it was run down and there was a lot that needed to be done. So we set about doing that, and Case and I, once we got together market farming, like, everything just came together, and, you know, we've built this place into, you know, a viable business. But originally I came here with the intention of growing more long-term subtropical crops and still maintaining a job potentially in land care or with the local land services or something in NRM, but farming on the side just to keep some capital coming in, yes, right?
So
so when Case and I met, and Case was, I really hadn't been exposed to, like, small scale biointensive market gardening type production before, even when I was woofing. So
this was Casey coming into the
picture. Yeah, totally. So yeah. I was sort of dabbling in lots of stuff and just fumbling my way through in many ways, and then I saw what Case was doing, and I was like, God, that's awesome. I need to know more about that. So, yeah, and this place lent itself to that, even though we are isolated in terms of distances from town, and, you know, we don't have a large city at our back door to tap into. The land up here, you know, it's incredibly fertile. It's got beautiful water, and it's as pristine as a farm could be, if that was ever a word, right?
Yeah,
so
So to take a snapshot then of what you're talking about, so it's 400 acres in size.
Yeah, the farm's 160 hectares, 400 acres. So it's a really, it's well and truly overkill for a market garden. Like, we only intensively farm about an acre of that. So the rest of it's forested country. We've got some incredible rainforest gullies on this property.
And having been cut to a large degree, so it's being regenerated.
Totally. So it's had a logging history and you know, it just feels really good having our environmental backgrounds that we do, you know, being able to farm on this property and also have that balance of conservation.
Yeah.
It feels so good.
Yeah, totally.
And like we've got 50 acres of river flat country, which we graze as well. But yeah, the majority of it is a conservation property. So as much as it's only a tiny portion that we derive an income from to be surrounded by this.
And being custodians of it,
totally.
And there's such value in that, which of course is where markets fall down as well. And we might hear a lot more about that Case, to the expertise you brought to the table then, the market garden out the back that now you've both got pumping and looks an absolute treat. And we'll of course have pictures that go out with this on the website. But tell us a bit about it, like what grows there and what was the path, I guess, of going about setting up the business that you've made viable, it's your thing, and how that did lead to the formation of the collective that you referred to before.
Yeah, so this is my fourth market garden that I was dabbling in. I did a 3-month internship down in Victoria at Transition Farm, who was a biodynamic small scale market garden. And then I moved up to Port to kind of
Port Macquarie.
Inland of Port to take over this farm. Market garden farm, but that didn't really work out. So then I started my own somewhere else in Port on another guy's land, which is where I met Tom.
And just on that, was that conflicted? Did it feel tough putting your heart and soul into something that perhaps didn't feel it was yours to tend for any duration of time?
Yeah, looking back on it, I'm like, what the hell was I doing there?
There we go. Yeah. Anyway, back onto to where we've ended up then.
Yeah, but you know, it all happens for a reason, and that's where I met Tom. And
there you go.
I was down the road from Tom's parents and could show him what I was doing and stuff. So, when I moved up here, I guess I'd had, you know, actually only maybe under 2 years' experience, maybe a year and a half or something of experience. So I was still pretty fresh, but we just started. Tom had ginger, turmeric beds started down where the garden is now, so they were growing, and then we just sort of started adding beds onto the end, just sort of growing whatever we could, trialing everything really, because you know that's how you learn.
Between the two gardens, Case was still farming down in Port for quite a fair bit of that, and I was sort of starting to dabble in a few veggies as well, and then we'd come together and sell up at Bellingen. Case would drive all the way up from Bellingen in the dark, and you know, it evolved like that.
Yeah, we were sort of doing markets together for a while, like in Kempsey and Port.
The stampede is on.
Yeah. Stampeding cattle.
We just started adding beds and growing, and kind of was pretty easy at the start, wasn't it?
Like, really?
Well, it was fresh
in
ground.
In some ways,
so, yeah. So it had never been intensively farmed before. It was just a cow paddock, so
yeah, you know, so the soil was good,
and it's on the river, it's beautiful alluvial soil, so yeah, so it was once we turned the ground and started putting crops in,
so it got quite big.
It's tiny. It's only the main growing space I think is only a third of an acre.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because when I say big, I was thinking about the amount you were and the diversity of what you were producing.
Yeah.
Has that got more than what you're doing now?
It's very intensive.
Yeah, we do things very, we push that garden very hard, but we, you know, we give back, you know, equally as much, if not more. So we look after it and it looks after us, but it's about 50 beds that are about a metre wide, a bit less, and those cows are having a really good time at the front there.
It is playtime as it approaches dusk.
50 beds that are about 25 metres long, and Yeah, we grow a lot of quick turnover crops now. So the evolution, we growed everything and anything and everything we could, and
yeah,
sort of realised that that was a bit of a nightmare. And now over the years, we've really honed it down to, you know, there's probably 10 crops that are our bread and butter, and that's a lot of really high value, quick turnover stuff. So lettuces and coriander and radishes and pak choy and salad mix are kind of our main things, but we do, there's always at least 10 to 15 sort of things growing.
Yeah. And then it came to the point, so it's working quite well. You even said it was a bit easy.
Wow.
Easy in terms of
producing.
Yeah, well, it was in the those drought. Early stages. It was the drought, yeah. Which there we go. Actually,
We've got water security here. Yeah. It's an amazingly part of the farm. The attraction of the farm was that there was an irrigation license that we inherited with the river.
Yeah.
So when you can just add water to crops, it's under as your opposed control. To pulling it away,
managing the flood.
So the dry. When I'm saying easy, I'm sort of referring to the
The
quality of the crops. That was all we knew. I'd only grown veggies really in drought conditions. So as long as you can add water, it's cool. And the thing is, you know, we all eat essentially mostly European vegetables in Australia, growing in a subtropical climate.
Mm.
So, you know, that doesn't make sense, but that's what people want. That's what we are all used to. So keeping those dry is actually really important. So we were just kind of thinking, oh, this is cool. This is easy.
This is working.
Yeah. And then we hit 2 years of rain, which was a different story.
So when and why did you broach joining forces with neighbours?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so part of the reason is, again, it comes back to being in a region with a small populace, but we are in, we call it sort of it's a food drought area as well. So we were all essentially, the three other farms, we're all market-based, so we all attend a local farmer's market. And, you know, we'd all turn up to those farmer's markets with very similar, somewhat similar crop list.
Yep.
And we are, as I was saying, being in a small population area, there's only so much you can, you know, you can get out there. So
it's a combination of things. It was like we were doing veggie boxes on our own, and we were sort of doing 20 to 30 boxes a week. And to have the diversity you need to keep customers happy and excited, you had to grow a lot of different things to have, you know, different things in their box each week. So we're growing a lot of different things on a really small scale to keep the boxes going. And then we were also doing farmers markets and, you know, having some of the same crops that other farms did. And at the same time, we were developing relationships with those farms, two of which were actually good friends of mine from a while back. So there was all these sort of things happening, and it just sort of seemed like the most logical thing to do would be to combine with other farms so we could grow less stuff ourselves, but keep like less varieties, but have that diversity really good.
Yeah.
Mm.
And not the overlap. So it's just win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there were a lot of talks between us initially, and I guess kind of pitched on how it could look if we all joined forces and kept the boxes going. And we also started doing a market together as well as the cooperative. But now we're just back to doing the boxes together with our collective. We do about 100 boxes a week in our valley, which is awesome.
And then you maintain the markets, but just on your own terms.
Yeah, that's great.
The boxes together, which you're gathering to do tomorrow. Like today was harvest day.
We still do collaborate at the markets. Like, for example, our neighbour who's the mushroom producer for the collective.
And the collective's called?
North Arm Farms.
North Arm Farms.
He sells our produce on Saturday, which is awesome. So we don't have to attend that market.
Because this is part of the thing, right? Mm. That can burn. Totally. You have to do everything.
You can't do it all. And, you know, we are, as I was saying before, in a low population area and we're a distance from places. So it's an hour and a bit to our local farmers market. You know, so if you were to do that, you know, that run twice a week, because there is the Wednesday and the Saturday, you know, you do. You just don't get enough time to get stuff done on the farm, or you burn out.
Yeah. And just, I mean, when you used the term before, food drought.
Yeah.
Because it so does apply
in
so much of Australia, let alone other places.
Yeah.
And so these realities apply.
Yeah.
It's why it doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's it.
That this is a really significant thing that you've managed to experiment with together.
Yeah, totally. Mm. We think it is.
Yeah, it's pretty rare. We don't really know of anyone working like this in Australia. There's a few other people that we know that sort of sell together, but not working together like this. Like, we're a 7-way partnership now. So we're in our second version of North Arm Farms. Mm. Originally, we had 3 couples and 3 farms. And one of those couples had to leave to go and get real jobs so they could afford to buy their own farm. So they've
Which is
gone
a
and
common story, unless you do have family who can chime in.
Yeah. Totally.
It's part of what we need to broach as a society.
Absolutely.
But go ahead.
Yeah. So they're doing that. They've managed to find land, but they've had two babies now. So they're just kind of in that zone. And so while that was happening, we had been getting to know another farm, Matt and Nicole Dolly's Run, who are also a local market garden that do the same thing as us. And our good friend moved back to the area to start a mushroom farm. So we had one couple leave and then we had 3 people just walk straight in and we just kept going and it was awesome.
Yeah. So what did you say? Seven-way collective.
Yeah.
7-way partnership.
Partnership, you call it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Would there be any sort of key lessons out of that for people hearing this who might go, ways of doing this that come off the top of your head that have been, like, even in potentially that shift across to your different model? Like, what would you say?
Well, we actually get asked all the time.
Do you?
Because there's a lot of interest in the model, and I think a lot of market gardeners can see, well, that's a really logical thing to do because we are growing such a diversity and it is a bit of a headache. So we get asked a lot of the time, like, what's the secret? What's the magic sauce?
Yeah.
And I think it's relationships.
Yeah.
And we're just so lucky to have these 7 people that are on the same wavelength and we have the same values about local food and community and the importance of our local resilient food system. So friendship. We're all really good friends.
Mm.
So I think, it's a bit of luck, to be honest. Yeah. Like, there's no magic ingredient. I think it's just having the right people around
you. I'm hearing it right through this whole story. We could peg luck on any number of things, from you finding this place to finding Casey
to what she
happened to bring to you didn't have.
And, absolutely.
And then that you connected as a couple.
Yeah.
And, luck, quote unquote.
whatever it is.
It's sort of this. There's a lot to be said for committing and following. I guess the thing that was bubbling up in you both, anyway.
Yeah, totally.
Sure. In terms of how it's playing out, I mean, it's also been revealed you're a demon with a spreadsheet and and structure.
Yeah.
So, I guess to just, I'm imagining that we shouldn't downplay the part of a bit of just straight up grunt organising, being clear. Is this true?
Yeah. It was a lot at the start. It was a lot to get, just had to learn, like, I've never managed people in that sense before. And farming is tough because there's no separation between your work life and your personal life. It's all just woven into this one thing. So it's really hard to separate, like, what's work, what's business, you know, what's friend, you know, what's, yeah. So
it's so interesting too, because I think we're in a time where a lot of people, me included, who aren't in farming, right, seek less of a division between, I mean, their values set, the like what they love in life and their work. But I hear you too, like, and you know, many people express, I want that division so I can be clear. So it's an interesting, in some ways, increasingly shared thing, I think, at the moment, to be thinking about that. Yeah. But anyway, proceed.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of conversations that sort of happened, and I sort of, yeah, a lot of spreadsheets, a lot of...
You're driving this, right?
Yeah, Casey is definitely the driver of it.
You're the manager who gets a bit of money for playing that role.
I do now, but for the first year or two, it was a lot of working for free. And, you know, we already had the box system going, but we're only doing 20 or 30 people. And so we just sort of upped that a lot and had to sort of, yeah, we just sort of figured it out. Like I'm really good at organizing things. I had it all in my head how it was going to work, and I just sort of had to bring everyone on board, which was relatively pretty easy. There was certain things that there was weird, you know, pushback on, and just learning how everyone operates and what they need, and how I've learned, you know, probably learned a lot about myself, to be honest, and the things that I do, and how to, you know, how some things, you know, I need to change myself.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a learning journey, but generally we've all been going in the same direction, and it's just always worked for everyone. Like it's just made everyone's lives so much easier to know that we've got this thing that happens every week, and we put our vegetables online and people buy them, and they're already paid for when we're out in the field harvesting. And
this is a critical point, right?
So
was that something you set up from the get-go?
Yeah.
It's sort of this CSA thing, right? Community-supported agriculture thing where would you say?
Well, not really. It's not really a CSA. It operates through the Open Food Network, which has been transformative.
Really? So listeners who might remember episode 126 and I think 63, when Kirsten was on originally. Tom, bless you. You know this.
I was listening to it this morning.
I'm a bit of a numbers person. I'm immediately thinking, oh, that was precisely double. What was going on there? But anyway, as an aside, but we spoke with Serenity and Kirsten in their home more recently. And, the explosion in that platform. Yeah. So it's really interesting speaking to you guys as people who were in it from the get-go.
Yeah.
And have experienced it in this transformative fashion.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we were with Open Food Network really early on when it was still free, and they were just figuring it out. Yeah, so we've had lots of communication back and forth over the years with them asking for our feedback and them sort of developing all these new tools as we've gone along. And, yeah, it's been cool to work with. Just knowing that you're supporting, you know, other local supporting farmers with this amazing platform who is supporting you, and it's just all feels good.
And where it is transformative, like what does it mean on the ground when you're trying to pull off what you're pulling off?
It makes logistics so much easier. Like
it's got the software stuff that you can tap into.
Yeah. So we just upload what we have, like the volumes. And then, you know, the shop opens every week. I just have to do a little bit of stuff, and then, you know, it spits out all the packing sheets, and, you know, everything's been collated already. So there's, you know, I don't have to do too much really. It takes me maybe an hour to do all the packing sheets and make sure everything's good for packing on a Wednesday. So it's an amazing little program, and we just heard about it. Like as we were about to start boxes like ourselves back in the day.
Yeah, I think it was at the Deep Winter gathering in Byron Bay, maybe. It would have been 2018. I think that was the first year we heard about it.
Yeah, so it just kind of appeared at the perfect time for us. And, it's been great. It makes our lives really easy. And it is designed for hubs and collaboration. So it works really well. Everyone can manage, each farm manages their own stocks and inventory, and it's all just linked together So it's, yeah, it's perfect for what we do.
Super interesting. Yep. Okay. So as we bring this thing to a close, I almost want to go back to the beginning again in the sense of, well, literally a First Nations presence in this area. And you're saying there is a fairly strong presence, and the town Bowraville is part of that, and there's some brilliant language reclamation stuff going on and so forth, but also the quintessential issues, if you like. But you are developing relationships there. Like, how is that sitting for you? What kind of importance does it have for you, and what's happening? What are you managing to broach in that space?
Well, it's been at the forefront of our mind for several years. But I guess it's like, where do you sort of, as farmers growing European vegetables,
totally,
where do we sort of fit into this, into this puzzle and into the picture? And there, because there is a strong presence in Bowra, there's a lot of services too in town. And I think it was you and, it's pretty well you, Case. You approached Penny.
Yeah, it's sort of funny. We've heard about, you know, pay the rent and those sort of organisations, we sort of explored that as an option. But it was like, well, there's this huge Indigenous community right here. Why don't we directly interact with them? So I had a chat with Trish from Mimi, which is an Indigenous women's centre in Bowraville, and sort of expressed maybe if they would like some vegetables as our kind of pay the rent. And they were really stoked with that because they've got a little community garden where they try and supply the elders with some veg. So we drop off excess stuff that we have and some of the staples that we sell from other farms, like potatoes and apples and bananas and stuff. So we drop that off each week, and
it's really well received.
Yeah, they're really grateful. That we have just tried to make that connection.
Yeah,
and you know, it's beautiful. There's a long way to go. The Bowraville community, it's got a lot of trauma, so there's a long way to go. But yeah,
well, knowing what we know. I mean, relationships, you said it all before, but also knowing what we know about nutrition, increasingly what we understand about nutrition, that's, yeah, again, a small but big broaching of the space. What else do you guys think about, you know, speaking of the value in the broader stewardship? I mean, we were talking before about how just in a way crazy, like probably in a lot of ways crazy, that you own this forest that I look over and that goes for 350 acres. It's the way our culture has come to understand land as commodity, isn't it? But here you are as certainly in your own mind, stewards of this country. And with the value of that, do you think about the things coming down the line like biodiversity credits and the like? Or is that not really front of mind? You're interested in other things?
Well, I just think it's sort of just intrinsic to who we are. We're not really looking at it from a monetary perspective. It's just to be on this land is privilege enough, and if we just never want to see a repetition of previous mismanagement. You know, this place has had a logging history, and when you live here and you get to know these forests and you walk amongst them every day, it'd be so traumatic to think that could all be, if this place was ever, you know, if we would ever go through a change of hands, for this place to lose that. I don't know. Yeah.
And you're actively looking into
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, with time definitely down the track, you know, there's already a voluntary conservation agreement on the property, but with time, you know, and these are the things we have to work through with family as well, because it's no minor matter putting a property under a binding sort of conservation agreement. So I think with time, that's where we'll definitely be heading, particularly protecting the really incredible rainforest gullies that are on this property. That is just is so crucial.
You're saying some old growth.
Yeah, there's definite old growth on this property. Unfortunately, the previous ownership logged out a lot of the older hardwood timbers, but those rainforest gullies protect the last of those older forests on this property. So,
and they are those classic, like, yeah, super big.
Yeah, we're talking like it's, you know, we back onto World Heritage Country here, and you know, you step into that World Heritage Country and you step onto this property and they're a mirror image, right? Yeah. So it's like within our ownership, whatever that means, like, we are the custodians of, you know, of some of that.
It makes me wonder, country. When I see some of the ranger programs coming on around the country, and how amazing some of them are going, it makes you wonder where the relationships you've started might be some period of time.
Oh, it's already happening.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. One of our good friends has just started one of those programs with Indigenous crew around here, with traditional fire management workshop.
There you go.
So yeah, it's an evolving space. That's for sure.
That's powerful.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, we'll do everything that we can to protect this country. And you grow to love it more and more with every day that you spend you know, time on this property. So
yep. Final question for you. You said you were certified organic, but you're not now. What happened there?
Well, one of the first things I did on this place when I first moved here in late 2016 was to look at organic certification, and we went into like a domestic type scheme back then in 2017 and put the whole property under certification. But as time evolved and we got to know the people who we were selling produce to, all that extra work that organic certification makes you go through, which, you know, is fair enough, but it just didn't seem like it was absolutely necessary for us anymore. So we ended up moving away from that. Do you want to speak to that case?
Yeah, we used to sell a little bit to Whole Food shops and cafes and send garlic down to Sydney, and so it was useful then. But now that we've gone to 100% direct to consumer, it's just not relevant to us. I still think there's a place for it. Two of the farms in our collective are certified organic. But we just, you know, everyone knows who we are around here, and it was just, you know, a few grand a year and an absolute headache that we could do without. So we obviously still grow organically, but we just don't have to. And it hasn't made one difference dropping it.
No.
Bang.
No.
Because I like to think that knowing that's where we need to go anyway, in closer relationship, and know where your food's coming from and how it's been done, and vice versa, right? The joy of having that connection, and let alone amongst fellow producers, all this stuff, that if you know and have a basis of trust, then there you are. Yeah, so that at least in more cases than it is now, not to say perhaps there's not a use for the other stuff too, but that it need not be universal and it need not be aspirational even. There are higher goals, and that's one of the tools we have. So it's to hear that that's the way it's worked for you guys is really something.
Yeah, it's all about that interface and telling those stories. And, you know, that's where the markets also play a major role, where, you know, you can have that direct relationship with the customer and communicate exactly how, you know, how we produce food and be 100% transparent about it. And we do that with the online store as well. So we don't want to poo-poo
organic
certification.
Yep. It's one of the tools.
But yeah, exactly.
And it's played a hell of a role, let's say.
Totally. But there's, you know, we're going, I think that system's going through a major shake-up at the moment too. So, you know, and there's other players coming into it as well with, you know, land to market stuff and various examples. So, you know, I think the whole system will eventually change into more of a, you know, organic certification's been very heavily inputs based, you know.
Yes.
keeping a sort of a paper trail of that and not so much the outcomes. So yes. I think that's probably where the shakeup's needed. You know, there's a lot of pretty average certification, organic certified producers, you know, out there doing some not so savoury land management practices. Mm. So
well said. Mm. So to close, what would you say have been the, let's see if there's a secret sauce to this. When you talked about the intensity of being all in on all things, how do you keep good as a couple in that space?
We sleep in different bedrooms.
And I'm building a new house. So that one over there. In all seriousness, yeah.
One of our big things is that our priorities are making sure we take summers off.
Yep, there you go.
So we put the whole garden under a cover crop over that period. And, you know, it's a bit of it's a breather time for us. Case and I get to come together and reflect on the year, but also hopefully, you know, do a bit of travel. We both love travel and it's dear to us. So it sort of keeps the flame burning from that perspective.
Yeah. No doubt, yeah.
Yeah, we generally go overseas for 3 weeks each January, which is huge for farmers, like, to take that time. And it's massive because even though we only go away for 3 weeks, we essentially lose, like, 12 weeks of income. So it's a huge, when you're already not making a huge income, that's a huge hit. But the value is just greater than that. We get to, it's really hard to have a farm and be on a farm and not work or not, you know, there's always something to do. So it kind of takes us leaving the country to actually shut off and rest. So we do that every January, which I think is a really beautiful reset for us. But on the day-to-day, we have very different roles. Tom manages the whole farm, whereas I'm mostly in the market garden. So we come together for each meal, but we're sort of not working together in between, which gives us some breathing space. And I think just having, we've got a really good community and friendship network around, so there's always stuff happening, so we're always making a priority to get off the farm or go on a weekend away or whatever. And yeah, it's taken a lot of time to get to that point. Like the first few years we kind of broke ourselves through, you know, working year round and exhaustion and stress. Now we're kind of, you know, we've had a lot of stress in the last year or two with La Nina, but we're kind of, you know, hopefully getting to this sweet spot where we can really kind of, it's humming and, you know, there's,
huge. And viability, like you're still making it, like with all these things and factoring in these times off, it is still working, hey? So well done.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. We couldn't see ourselves doing anything else, could we?
Right on.
No, totally. Yeah.
Beautiful. All right, what music do you happen to be listening to right now or that has been significant at some stage in your life?
I know Casey's one.
I'd do love you? To.
Yeah.
No, what? We were joking about it. Oh, okay, yeah, right now I've been listening a lot to Sampa the Great, who is this amazing chick who sings so much about female empowerment and stuff. So her song Energy is like, we'll put that on in the morning sometimes to get in the zone while breakfast.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
This is what I want to know. Yeah. And you, mate?
Oh, hey, Jay, it's so hard. Like, I'm such a...
You've been thinking about this for years?
I actually have. That's the funny thing. And I love so... Like, my music repertoire is extremely diverse, I'd say. I think you can attest to that, Case. But, yeah, I reckon the song that probably comes to mind is Valley by John Butler, actually.
There you go.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful song and I think pretty apt for this place.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Immediately apparent.
Yeah.
Beautiful, so. You guys. What an absolute pleasure. It's been so great speaking with you. It's a brilliant story. that you share and that you're on about. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be with you in this place talking about it. Thanks.
It's been so good to have you on the farm, AJ. Yeah, we've been so excited to have you here.
That was Tom McIndoe and Casey Simong at Mandarin Bend Farm in the Nambucca Valley on Gumbunya Country on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. For more on Casey and Tom, Mandarin Bend, North Arm Farms, how to access their food if you're in that neck of the woods, and if you're in or near Sydney, how to get along to the Sydney Film Festival this weekend for its final screening of Rachel's Farm, the new film Tom and Casey appear in, see the links in the show notes. I'll also include a link to my conversation with Kirsten and Serenity from the Open Food Network. And you'll also find a link to the next big regenerative agriculture event in Australia, in Margaret River, WA, in September. I'm privileged to be the MC and hope to see some of you there. Finally, huge thanks to Blair Beatty from Farmers Footprint Australia for taking the driver's seat on our journey south from the Northern Rivers to visit Tom and Casey and Rachel's farm. Join us at the latter next week. For subscribers, I'll continue to send you behind-the-scenes stuff and other news of what's unfolding as I get around the country. And if you've been thinking about becoming a subscriber, I'd love you to join us. It's with thanks, as always, to this community of generous supporters that this episode was made possible. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support. Thanks again. And as always, please share this episode if you can think of someone who might enjoy it. And do rate and review it on your favourite app. It all helps. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.